Since leaving the Betty Ford Center, Cash had been clear-headed enough to return to his manuscript about the Apostle Paul, and in March 1986, he completed it during a writing stint at the farm in Bonacqua, Tennessee, his two-story country retreat outside of Nashville. For someone used to telling stories in three verses in a chorus, a 90,000-word novel had been an ambitious task. His favorite novelists were James Michener, The Source, Colleen McCulloch, The Thornbirds, Jack Higgins, and Stephen King. He was a great lover of historical fiction, and even in his last days was reading Aztec by Gary Jennings on a magnified image projector. He modeled his novel of the Apostle Paul, The Man in White, on the biblical novels he had first read when he and June married, The Robe by Lloyd C. Douglas, The Silver Chalice by Thomas B. Costin, and Ben-Hur by Lew Wallace. The publication of The Man in White coincided with news that Columbia would not renew its contract with Cash. After 31 years as a recording artist, 28 of them with Columbia, Cash was suddenly a man without a label. Columbia's Nashville head, Rick Blackburn, cleaned house, and Cash was one of the casualties. The reason was basic. Cash was no longer selling records in large volumes, and radio stations pursuing the coveted 18 to 24-year-old market share didn't think a 54-year-old, whose first hits appeared on the charts in the 50s, should top their playlists. They didn't care for what he was putting out, says Lou Robin. When John's contract expired, Rick Blackburn called me and told me he wasn't going to renew it. I was a little surprised. I'm sure that Rick had been given orders from higher up. It was 1986, and Cash's statistics as a solo artist didn't help his case. He hadn't had an album in the pop top 200 since One Piece at a Time a decade before. Columbia argued that shifting demographics left little hope of a career revival, especially since his songs were plowing the same old furrows. He argued back that because Columbia lost faith in him, they stopped promoting him, so they were to blame for the poor sales figures. Cash hadn't made it easy for himself. He had clearly lost enthusiasm for recording and often skipped the mixing sessions. Even his staunchest fans considered one of his last singles for Columbia, The Chicken in Black, rock bottom. He actually dressed up in a superhero blue cape, yellow jersey, and tights for the video, which was shot at Citizens Bank in Nashville. In 1988, he admitted to Bill Flanagan of Musician magazine that the song was indeed awful, but he blamed it on producer Billy Sherrill. I hated it from the first day, and I refuse to admit that I even know the words to it anymore. It was an embarrassment. Every once in a while, I'll do something that embarrasses me, like anybody. It's good to let the people know you have a sense of humor. There may be some truth to the amended story, since the B-side of that release, The Battle of Nashville, was an undisguised attack on the record company. Many times I've regrouped my emotions and smiled through the struggle and pain and made believe I'm all together, just like I'm doing again. But my little defeats keep on coming, 'cause you keep on holding the line. I'm losing ground with you daily, and it's just a matter of time. And the battle of Nashville is raging. There's a troubling deep in my soul. Here's my swan song for Music City, 'cause my forces are out of control. I have hoped against hope that you'll love me, and my heart won't give up the fight. So the battle of Nashville continues. And pray you'll surrender tonight. The Battle of Nashville, 1984. Despite the layoff from Columbia, Robin remained upbeat with the press. He said that they already had a lot of interest from other labels and reminded them that Cash was far more than just a recording artist. He was a touring performer, a TV host, an author, and a movie actor. On August 21st, Cash signed a new deal with PolyGram Records in Nashville to release his records on the Mercury label. PolyGram Nashville's president, Dick Asher, and vice president of marketing, Steve Popovich, both got to know Cash while working for Columbia. Their view was that Cash was a prestige artist and that the association with him would be good for their Mercury label. They also thought Cash could sell some records if handled well. "We knew that Columbia was about to drop him," says Popovich. "There was a change about to happen. As Rick Blackburn put it, the torch was about to be handed to another generation. I was always totally against this idea of getting rid of these older artists. They were the people who had built country music and they had millions of fans." For his first Mercury album, Johnny Cash is Coming to Town, he worked again with Jack Clement, whom he regarded as something of a talisman in his career, but Others thought had steered him away from his vision by going for the lightweight and the obviously commercial. Clement had produced Ballad of a Teenage Queen, and I guess things happened that way. When Sam Phillips lost interest in Cash at Sun, helped restore Cash's reputation at Columbia with his work on Ring of Fire, and was around to supply songs for Everybody Loves a Nut after Cash was arrested. He produced The Adventures of Johnny Cash. He was almost family. David Fergie Ferguson, an engineer who played an important role in the last 10 years of Cash's recording life, came along as Clement's assistant. He wanted attention, says Ferguson. Columbia had slammed the door on him. He was happy to have a new buddy engineer and to be working with Jack Clement again. He recorded the songs he wanted to record and was happy to be sparing no expense on recording and to be able to use any instrumentation he wanted to. He loved all that. He was having a good time, but he was disappointed because every time we recorded something, nobody would do anything with it. He made great records, but nobody would push them. That's the pity of it. Interviewed in 2000, Cash confirmed that working with Jack Clement in the 1980s was the happiest period of my recording career. Johnny Cash is Coming to Town was promoted as Cash's comeback album, but in 1988 he commented, "That's what they said, but that album didn't make it very big. If I'm going to make a comeback record-wise, I've still got that comeback to make. But meanwhile, I'm doing what I enjoy, so what's the difference? I've always done what I wanted to do. I've never looked at the charts and grieved because my name wasn't in there." Cash's next recording was an album of duets, Water from the Wells of Home, which started with a song he recorded with June, Where Do We Go Right, followed by the title track, co-written with John Carter. Also on the record were songs with Roy Acuff and Glenn Campbell. "Then I was in the studio and Waylon came in, so Waylon and I did a duet," he said. "We got talking about other people I'd like to sing with, so I got Emmylou Harris and Hank Williams Jr. I have a track cut for my daughter Roseanne and the Everly Brothers." When last at Cinnamon Hill, he had been visited by Tom T. Hall and Paul McCartney, and the three of them had written a song, which was also included on the album. When Cash was next in England, he recorded it with a former Beatle at his studio in the West Sussex countryside. "It sounds terrific," Cash said the next day. "We were at my house right after New Year having one of our all-night singings and guitar pulls on the front porch. We'd been singing for about 6 hours and the moon started setting, and Tom T. Hall had this idea for a song called New Moon Over Jamaica. We wrote the song together." The late 1980s also, unfortunately, marked the start of Cash's serious health problems. On May 16, 1987, while playing a concert in Council Bluffs, Iowa, he stopped in the middle of his second song. He started to talk to the audience but found his speech slurred and indecipherable. Realizing something was horribly wrong, June stepped forward from the wings and escorted him backstage, where he remained for 10 minutes. When he reached the coronary unit of Mercy Hospital, doctors there diagnosed an irregular heartbeat. The concert was canceled. Photos of him coming off stage show him staring wildly, looking confused and afraid. Cash's publicity team attributed the incident to exhaustion from his heavy schedule of recording, touring, and signings for A Man in White. Lou Robin confirmed that, though he had no history of heart problems, he did suffer from high blood pressure. He spent 2 nights in the hospital and then flew back to Nashville. He didn't play again until June 13th. In March 1988, he checked into the Eisenhower Medical Center in Palm Springs, California, to be treated for laryngitis and bronchitis. Then on December 13th, he went to Baptist Hospital in Nashville for a routine checkup and learned the following day that he had a 90% blockage at the junction of two coronary arteries supplying blood to his left ventricle. He needed immediate bypass surgery. His operation started at 8 a.m. on December 19th and lasted for 2 hours. According to Cash, he smoked a cigarette 30 minutes before being given the anesthetic. Surgeons used blood vessels from his chest and leg to bypass the blockage. Waylon Jennings, who had undergone the same operation exactly a week before, was resting in a private room after coming out of intensive care on December 17th. Roy Orbison had died of a heart attack on December 6th at his Hendersonville home.